Hello, and welcome to the eighth episode of the Secular Foxhole podcast. Today, Martin and I have a great guest from the Ayn Rand Institute. We're going to be speaking with Aaron Smith, who is an instructor and fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute. It teaches at the Objectivist Academic Center on ARI campus and ARI's internship program. He teaches and designs educational content for the Institute's intellectual training and e-learning programs. He writes, speaks, and gives interviews for the Institute and provides intellectual and editorial support to a variety of ARI's programs. Welcome, Aaron.
Thanks, Blair.
You're welcome.
Hi, Aaron.
Yes, the reason Martin. I asked you on.
Yes,
yeah, hi. The reason I asked you on.
Right? We're all playing high here.
Yeah.
Okay. I apologize, Martin.
No problem.
The reason I asked you on, Aaron, is that you had written a critique of Stoicism, which has gained popularity in the last 5 or 10 years. Several authors and podcasters apparently are living by it or swear by it. And can you give us a brief history and where it fits in the history of ideas? And then we'll talk about your criticism.
Sure. Yeah. So the article that I wrote was called The False Promise of Stoicism. And like you said, it is critical of Stoicism as a philosophy. I want to start, I think, by separating out some of the modern popularizers of Stoicism today, people like Ryan Holiday or Tim Ferriss. And I think
there's
a reason why I want to make that separation, because we can come back to talk about Stoicism as it originally was developed as a philosophic system in ancient Greece from some of the popularizing versions today, because some of the critiques of the original Stoic philosophy don't apply in the same kinds of ways to some of the modern versions of them that people find today, because I think those are a very mixed bag of some useful things. Of some things that definitely are helpful and that they apply, and some things that I think are less useful or not as helpful in the sense that they don't come together as with an integrated worldview. It's more self-help. And I don't mean that in a disparaging way, but it's more self-help tips, hacks, and so on. But if we look back to Stoicism as it originally was formulated, I'll just say for, I don't know who exactly the audience is here, but it's an ancient Greek philosophy. Stoicism is an ancient Greek philosophy that began in what historians call the Hellenistic period. So this is basically the period starting from around the death of Aristotle in 322 BC, or alternatively, you could put it as the death of Alexander the Great in the following year, to the rise of the Roman Empire. So that's the basic period where Stoicism was originated or formed. And that's the period that comes after the classical period, which people know a little bit more about. This is the period of Socrates, Plato, Aristotle, the Peloponnesian War, the Greco-Persian Wars, and so on. And the school was founded by a guy named Zeno of Citium. He started teaching in Athens around 300 BC. So that's about 20 years after Aristotle's death. Eventually, the members of the school started to be called Stoics, after their meeting place, which was the Painted Stoa. Stoa is like a kind of roofed colonnade. And there was a place called the Painted Stoa in Athens where they would meet and discuss and so on. And Zeno was really influenced in his thinking by a couple of things. One, portrayals of Socrates, the philosopher, in Xenophon's Memorabilia. Socrates, I think, was very influential on all subsequent philosophers in Greece. And he was often looked to as a kind of a model for what a philosopher really looks like, or how he behaves, lives his life, what his concerns are, and so on. Zeno had an interaction with and spent some time with a philosopher named Crates. It was a philosopher of what they call the Cynic school, who taught that virtue is the only good, and that virtue is sufficient for happiness. So basically what the Cynics did is they shunned or abandoned all social conventions. You know, they live on the street and so on, because the idea was all you need was virtue, and then you have everything you need in life. And he was very much influenced by him. And in terms of the development of the school, I mean, we'll talk a bit about what their philosophic ideas are, but Zeno had two major successors as sort of the leaders of Stoic philosophy. One was Cleanthes, who seemed to be mostly concerned with cosmology and theology. And then he was succeeded by Chrysippus. Now, Chrysippus is the primary or chief architect of Stoicism as an integrated, systematic philosophic system. I mean, he wrote a ton and on a wide range of topics, from logic, from the syllogism, rhetoric, ethics, cosmology, theology, epistemology. There's just, it's really a systematic kind of thinker. And so when we talk about, and there's some hesitation about using this term, but when we talk about orthodox Stoicism, it's usually we're referring to basically to Chrysippus or the system of philosophy that Chrysippus constructed. And the school continued on through the Roman imperial period, where you get more familiar names, people like Seneca, Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, you know, who was an emperor. And figures like that are the more known. And in terms of the modern Stoic movement today, mostly they're talking about people like Seneca, Epictetus, Marcus Aurelius, the people of the Roman imperial period. I think, and for one major reason is that we actually have their texts, which is helpful. Basically, all the other Stoics, we get reports and quotes or alleged quotes in other works, so that none of them, nothing survived except reports. And whereas in the case of Seneca, we have some of his letters, Epictetus, he had some works preserved by a student. Marcus Aurelius, we have his meditations in some form. So basically, as a philosophic school, Stoicism flourished from basically the 3rd century BC to the 3rd century AD, so about 600 years. And then, you know, basically Christianity took over and just the world changed.
I see. I see. Now, reaching back in what you just said earlier, something struck me as odd. You said that they just wanted to be virtuous and carry on their lives. Well, how did they know what virtue was? Or did they even, you said they just live in the street or whatever. So did they not have a definition or?
Well, so the people that lived on the street and said that virtue is the sufficient for happiness and so on, those are philosophers called the Cynics. Now, the founder of Stoicism was influenced by them, but his view is different. Yeah, they all had some kind of a conception of what virtue is. And the Greek philosophers were actually, all of them formulated some perspective about what virtue is or what the virtues are, what the various virtues are. But
I see.
It's more about, I mean, the focus on virtue is more an issue of the focus on the internal state of one's soul or the internal state of one's character. And they had traditional virtues like courage, temperance, justice, wisdom, you know.
Okay.
But they hovered around those kinds of traditional sort of virtues. But the idea was it's the focus on one's inner state, one's inner condition, not on one's outward, let's say, social status, the amount of wealth you have, whether you're in prison or at a villa in Rome. It's the focus on the internal and the internal state, not externals. And that was really influential on the Stoics because they make a strong divide between what they call externals. And these are things external, I would put it external to one's will, things over which you don't really have control, like how much money you ultimately have or what kind of home you have, because all of these things can be taken away from you. They can be destroyed. You don't have full control over any of these kinds of things. You could get thrown in prison. You could get hit by a bus. And there's all sorts of things in life where you don't actually have direct control over. And so these are the things that can be taken away from you. You can lose them. And so part of the Stoic perspective is to not become too attached to those things. You know, you can use them while they're here, but remember, they're on loan, so to speak, from the universe. And, you know, just don't get too attached to those things because you'll disturb your own interstate and you wind up focusing your time and effort and your life on things that don't really ultimately matter. But what really matters for the Stoics is the internal state of your soul, your character, and what you have control over. And so the issue of control is something I have a criticism about, but that's, anyway, that's in a way the way they pitch it.
I see. Now, it's interesting that you mentioned the time frame because I'll take a stab and say that because they were deterministic, that led to their decline and the rise of Christianity. Is there sort of a corollary?
I don't think it's the determinism per se. So just for the audience, determinism is the view. I mean, this is how I formulate it. Okay. Determinism is the view that all of your actions and choices including everything that happens in the universe, is necessitated. So there is no room for free will in the sense where you, like a human being, would have the ability to choose in the same situation, under the same circumstances, to choose more than one option. In other words, you face real crossroads in life where you and your choice is what makes the difference. And neither of the two choices are necessitated by factors outside your control. They're within your control, and you're the one who makes the difference. So that's an issue of free will. They reject free will, and that saying that is somewhat controversial as well. And we could talk about their view on that. But so I don't think it's the determinism that is the connector between Stoicism and Christianity, but I think there is a deep connection between the two. And it's the way I formulate it is, for me, the deepest way I can formulate what Stoicism amounts to is it's a kind of dualism. It's a kind of metaphysical dualism in which you have a rational or spiritual element trying to gain mastery over and freedom from the physical, the material, the bodily element. And this is something it shares with Platonism and with, in general, with religious worldviews. So in Stoicism, it's the focus on the inner, not the outer. It's the focus on the mind, the state of one's character, not on one's material condition or wealth or the goods that you've acquired or the business you built or whatever it is. So there's a focus on the inner world, not the outer world. And also, so we're getting into Stoic philosophy here, but they have a view that God pervades everything in the universe, literally pervades everything in the universe. So there's two things in the universe, basically. One is a divine, rational, active force, which they call God. They also call it Zeus. They also sometimes equate it with a cause, some kind of a cause, but it's the only active thing. It's the only active shaping force in the universe. And it literally pervades everything, rocks, plants, a teacup, and everything else is inert matter. So there's a kind of a divine, rational, spiritual agency, which is material, by the way, for them. And then there's just sort of an inert matter that is being shaped. And that's what's in the universe. And our own reason is a fragment of that divine, rational force in us. And sometimes they'll put it as God gave us a fragment of himself that makes us distinctively rational beings like God. And so that we have a kinship with God and so on. So you get this, there's a rational spiritual force, and then there's inert matter. And the important thing is this rational spiritual force, not the matter. So when it comes to ethics, Stoics will often don't be so concerned about whether you have material goods or the condition of your body. It's all about the inner. And I think religion is a lot like that, that there's some kind of divine mind or consciousness or spirit, which is the important thing in the world. And then matter, material goods, the physical, the bodily, the needs of the body, you know, sex, food, all of these sorts of things we sort of disparage. So it's a kind of a mind, as objectivists put it, it's kind of a mind-body dichotomy. Okay. And I think that it shares with religion. And more you get internalized, focus on spirit, on the inner, not on the outer, I think that you start to move more toward, and I think Stoicism is in part the cause of, and in part a reflection of, the movement, the slow movement of the Greek world from an essentially secular culture to a religious one, to a more religious one, put it that way.
Aaron, and I think that's interesting to follow your ideas here and the line here. So I will jump a bit forward, but I will come back to the roots and your criticism too also. But I was reflecting because I've seen the popular, how it become in new media and others, and also reading books. And they say, I could see then relation to like, you know, Martin Luther and this pain thing, that is like the Stoic is like a warrior, go through hell and go through hardships and don't think about it because, yeah, we said some you can't control over it. Is that, could that be one effect of this, or that it become a bit popular in that way, or is drawing consequences?
Well, I think the popularity in so we're moving to thinking about modern Stoicism and the way it's portrayed. If you hold out to people the following values, I think their response is going to be positive. And so, resilience,
Yeah.
Invulnerability against adversity. Courage, the ability to weather pain and suffering in a way that doesn't disturb your tranquility or your peace of mind. I mean, who doesn't want
exactly.
that? Right? So, one of the things about, I heard somebody tell me once that one of the great things you can do with marketing is if you can get an audience of people who are suffering and looking for answers, and there aren't very good answers around, and you've got one, that's a great position to be in. And I think this is one of the appeals or the reason why it's popular today is, you know, people are looking for self-help advice. Mm. And again, by self-help, I don't mean that disparaging.
Right. Sure.
I mean, self-help is good. So people are looking for self-help advice. They're often disillusioned by traditional answers, by traditional religion, but they think they want something spiritual, something that has some meaning, but they don't want to get into religion. Some of them, people are often unhappy and they're looking for some kind of guidance and perspective that'll make them be able to better cope with what they're dealing with, you know, and who doesn't want peace of mind, relief from suffering, delimiting the number of things you have to worry about. So you're not always stressed out or a lot of anxiety. And
yeah, right? No kidding.
you need these things. And Stoicism is offering, and they say, look, if we look back, and there's a little bit of marketing to this, I think, but look back to the wisdom of the ancients, you know, everyone's always looking for wisdom from the ancients. But seriously, if they're saying that there is a philosophic system that was, if not necessarily designed for this, useful in helping people cope with stress, anxiety, suffering, pain, worry, how to orient yourself, it gives one a perspective on life and on oneself and on what one is capable of, what one should worry about, what kind of values you should pursue or not, in a way that's designed to relieve psychological, I think, discomfort and reach a peace of mind. Because I mean, I'm the last person to disparage peace of mind. And so this is what it's tapping into and then offering some kinds of advice and tips for.
So I'm wondering if, go ahead, Martin.
Yeah, and we could jump to that also then conclusion, because I thought you had a nice coined a phrase there, like a Stoic cafeteria. So when you go to the cafeteria or the buffet, and you pick some random dishes or dishes, and then you are satisfied. Is that the solution, or is that what you think is the main problem with this, like, modern version of it? Even if it could be self-help, as you say, in a positive way.
I think it goes both ways in the sense that there's a value in doing that, and there's a problem with that. So you can dip in to Stoicism. Grab a few points that you think are actually helpful for you, disconnect them from their original philosophic context and justification, and use them all like separated out from Stoicism. Fine. Sometimes you should separate this stuff from Stoicism because the Stoicism is the problem sometimes. So there's nothing wrong with grabbing wisdom where you can find it. So, and I think that's often where people are getting more of the legitimate value, is they're separating it from the Stoic context and using it in a more rational, more sensible way. And we can talk about some of what those ways are. But the problem is, I think what people need is they need an operating system, not a set of hacks. They don't need an app. They need an operating system. You know, you need a philosophy. You need an integrated view of yourself in the world and what you're capable of, how you reach knowledge. You need an integrated perspective, a worldview, if you want to put it that way. And often what you get from Tim Ferriss is not a worldview. And it's not to disparage Tim Ferriss, but it's not a worldview. It's not a philosophic system.
Mm-hmm.
It's something of a Stoic oriented perspective on life, goals, valuing, which you can spin in all sorts of ways. And again, spin, I don't mean that disparaging. You can apply or tease out some kind of wisdom from it. Like you could write, what's the book that Ryan Holiday wrote, the Daily Stoic?
Right.
365 days on, I don't know, Stoic reflection or whatever it was. That's not the right title. But you could do this with objectivism, the Daily Objectivist. And you could take 365 quotes taken from Ayn Rand's works. And in a way that's not actually consistent with objectivism, pull out something you say, hey, here's a tip, here's something you can use. You know, imagine you're at work and this such and such happens and you could apply this knowledge to here and in a way that where you don't get a sense that there's any philosophic system there. Mm-hmm. It's a bunch of tips that some sensible, some less sensible advice that you could build off of that. So here's one way of putting this. So Massimo Pigliucci is, he's a philosopher of science. I think his background is in biology mostly. And he wrote a book on Stoicism. And there's another guy, William Irvine, he's a philosophy professor, wrote another book on Stoicism. And both of these figures will say in the introduction that, well, Stoicism, you know, you can be religious and be a Stoic. You can be an atheist and be a Stoic. You can be a, like all sorts of, you can be a Buddhist and be a Stoic. And so you get the sense that it's not really a worldview. It's not really an integrated system where you have to make it consistent. You wouldn't say with objectivism. I basically agree with objectivism, but I throw out free will. Mm-hmm. I mean, you throw out objectivism if you do that. Or I'm an objectivist, but I'm a theist. You know, I think there's a God and I build that. You know, that's not objectivism. I mean, you couldn't do that.
Right.
I think what the moderns are starting to do is basically shrink what the Stoicism they're selling, so to speak. Shrink it down to ethics. And there is some metaphysics there in the sense that they think the universe is causal and so on, which the Stoics agreed. They accepted the universe was fully causal. And so you can kind of tease out or you could present a modern version of some sort of metaphysics on that. But basically, it's like, look, things function by cause and effect. That's the way the world works. It's a deterministic world. And here's a view about ethics. So they'll call it the philosophy of life. And I think that's really often meant implicitly or explicitly to kind of shrink it to ethics, in essence.
Mm. Would the noticeable decline of organized religion, you think that's contributed to the rise of Ryan Holiday and Tim Ferriss and all that? Or, I mean, dovetailing on, you know, the earlier time.
I'm not so sure that people like Ryan Holiday or Tim Ferriss are, I don't think their popularity is as a result of there's a decline in religion and people are looking elsewhere. The decline in religion causes people to look elsewhere for meaning and values.
Okay.
And I think the primary value of, again, I don't consume a lot of Tim Ferriss's or Ryan Holiday's work, though I've read some and I've listened to, I mean, I can get a sense of what they're saying and all, but I get the perspective that they're primarily offering perspective and advice.
Okay. Yeah.
And in many cases, it's useful perspective and advice. It's sensible. In some cases, it's not. Both of them, they're not philosophers. And I think that's important. So both when being critical of something that an approach they take, I can say as a philosopher, I can say, well, this is not very philosophical. On the other hand, you could say, yeah, they're not philosophers. So they're not really offering a philosophy per se, even though they might, you know, put it that way. Mm. So there's all sorts of people that you can get some sort of sensible or sensible sounding perspective from that it's worth listening to. I mean, I know people who listen to their shows on a regular basis and they really enjoy it. They feel like they get something out of it. I think it's mainly that put it this way, yeah. What they're offering is something that people take as practical.
Okay.
And today philosophy doesn't offer you anything practical at all.
Yeah. It's often only in academia. Yeah, I've read plenty of Tim Ferriss books and listened to his show and his newsletter and so on. So I enjoy them. And we'll come back to Ryan Holiday about the book title there.
Yes,
discuss. But it's interesting to hear your perspective, Aaron, about it. But it's like a vacuum and it's filling in with some life hacks, some positive things mainly. And it's interesting also how these ideas have been inspiring individuals that we all look up to, entrepreneurs, inventors, athletes, etc. And that you wrote in the beginning of the article. Also,
I think
it's fascinating.
I think it's important to say, to get on the table, what is it that they're finding valuable in Stoicism because, or in the versions or the modern versions of Stoicism that are being presented today? And the two major ones definitely stand out. One issue is and this is true of objectivism too. This is true of Ayn Rand's philosophy as well.
Okay.
The Stoics, I think, were the first to really fully get, fully realize, and really make serious use of the fact that emotions have cognitive roots. Now, this started to get, Plato started to get some of this, and Aristotle basically understood it, but it didn't play a big role in his philosophy. Whereas the Stoics, it's a central aspect to their worldview. The central aspect to your perspective is this. Emotions are they're not just bolts from the blue. They're not just unquestionable absolutes. You have them. That's the way you feel. That's it. That's, like it or not, whatever. They're emotions. They just come on you and you have to deal with them. Their view is no, your emotions come from your judgments. And it's, why do you have the emotion that you do? Well, it's because you've made certain judgments of fact, like what's the case, and certain judgments of it, that fact's relationship to you and your life and your goals and so on. And it's because of those judgments that you feel the way you do. So, I mean, a simple example is somebody steals a plate from your house. If you don't care about the plate, you're not going to be that upset, right? If it's an expensive plate, or it has some kind of personal meaning to you, like it was given to you by someone important, or, I mean, if somebody breaks into your house, you'll be worried about that. But I'm saying, if you lose something, but you drop it and you can't find it, but you don't really care much about it, you're not that disturbed, right? But if it's something really important, in other words, if your judgment is that this is really important and the loss of this something is a genuine loss, you're going to feel a sense of loss, a sense of sadness and so on. But if you actually don't care about it, you won't feel those kinds of emotions. So the kinds of emotions that you feel, another example of this is somebody's driving in front of you and they're driving really slow and it's really irritating. And you're like, come on, you know, get out of the way. It's kind of, this is not very respectful. It's like, you're trying to get to work or whatever. And you start to experience feelings of anger or frustration or whatever. And then you drive past them and you realize that the person's injured. Well, your emotions change immediately to maybe care or concern or worry instead of anger and frustration, because your judgment of the facts and the situation change. Now you realize it's not somebody being annoying or disrespectful. It's somebody who's in trouble. They were the first to, I think, really realize and make serious use of the fact that you can actually then take control of your emotional life. You can manage your emotional life by managing the underlying judgments that give rise to your emotions. So you don't have to take your emotions for granted. And I think people legitimately find that really empowering. I think they should find that empowering. I mean, so I learned this point from Ayn Rand. I mean, the Stoics got to that point first, long ago, but it's a truth, and it's really valuable once you can learn to make, as long as you're making rational use of that, that's helpful. And I think many people are getting this for the first time from the Stoics, and like, wow, I can take control of my emotional life. I don't have to settle. And I can, if I think about, am I having rational judgments? I can get my emotions in line with that. And my emotions can be more, I don't know, rational as a result, if you want to put it that way. That's one point, the managing your emotions, because they have roots in your judgments. Control the judgments, control the emotions. There are all sorts of irrational ways you can do that too, but definitely, right? Because what are your judgments? You know, so anyway, the second thing is that you have to make a clear distinction between what's up to you and what's not, what you can control and what is out of your control. And Ayn Rand makes a big deal of that too, like in her essay, The Metaphysical versus the Man-Made. I mean, that's a complex article, but it's a super important issue to get right. I think the Stoics get it wrong, but they're right to make that a really important thing that you have to think about in life. And people can wreck their lives by thinking, this is up to me, or I feel guilty about something, I should have done it better. And when things are just actually out of your control and you're not responsible for them, you can't affect them. And yet you spend so much time worrying about it or trying to deal with it it makes no sense to do that. And you should really be spending your time on things that you can actually control or impact or causally affect in some way for the better. But you have to know how to draw the line between those kinds of things, because it's not always obvious just how much is in your control. Like Ayn Rand gives the example of the person who thinks, I want to be a composer. And they just ask, oh, do I have what it takes? Like, as if it's just I either have it or I don't. And it's like, no, that's not the way to think about it. It's you have to learn what is involved in the task of composing music, how to write music. There's a whole causal story of things that you would have to learn to do it. And you can think, for example, that you should just have some innate talent or you don't. In other words, it's out of my control whether I can be a composer or not. I either have that X factor or I don't. And there are all sorts of subtle ways in which people can make subtle and not subtle ways in which people can confuse those two. So I think those are two things which people are actually finding legitimately valuable, separating out what you can control and what you can't, trying not to worry too much about the thing you can't have any impact over, because all you do is fill your life full of anxiety and worse. And also the fact that you can have some control over your emotional life by managing the judgments that underlie them.
Yeah, well, the main goal in life should be happiness, obviously. So I think that's how you end your article.
Yeah, from the objectivist perspective, your moral goal is happiness. The moral purpose of your life is happiness. All the Greek schools of philosophy held that the goal is, we can translate it happiness if we want, but it's eudaimonia. It's some kind of flourishing state, which has a psychological component and an existential component. But they have very different views of what eudaimonia is and what it consists of. Whether it's contemplation or a life of virtue or it's physical pleasure or it's, as the Stoics put it, living in accordance with nature. And so they all have different, somewhat different conceptions of what happiness consists of. So we can say that they're all concerned with, quote, happiness, or they're all concerned with eudaimonia, but they have very different views about what that is and consists of. So for them, basically, happiness, when they put it as living in agreement or living in accordance with nature. And the basic idea there is you have to come to understand your own nature as a human being and the nature of the world around you and have a kind of a harmony. And if you live in accordance with your own nature and live in accordance, self-consciously and explicitly with the nature of nature. And okay, that sounds sensible, right? You don't want to live out of harmony with your own nature or the nature of the world around you. You'll just screw everything up, right? You'll fail. But oops. Part of what I take to be the problem of Stoicism is that it's their view of the nature of nature and it's their view of the nature of human beings that makes their view problematic. So they have a whole view of it. The universe is a one deterministic system fixed by God, providentially ordered for the benefit of man, whereas everything that happens had to happen exactly as it does. And that your role in this, because God is, benevolent and rational and providential, and he's made everything for the best, which is their view. It's your role in the world is to play the part that God assigned you in the world in this great play. In effect, the universe or life is like a play written by God, and your job, in effect, is to play your assigned role. And sometimes they'll put it as, look, if you were born cripple, play the role of a cripple. If you were born poor, play the role of a poor person. If you were born into a family with political connections and expectations for government of like positions and so on, play that role. And you get the sense that it's not about shaping your own destiny. And this is a major difference between objectivism, Ayn Rand's philosophy, and Stoicism, is that Stoicism is essentially about accommodation. Now, this is the way I formulated it. Other people might disagree with this, but I think it's essentially about accommodation, accommodating yourself to nature, to fate, to your lot in life, to one's duties, given one's social role, of playing your assigned part in a grand play that nothing can change anyway. And objectivism is essentially about ambition. It's about ambitiously crafting your life, your character, about thinking seriously about what your own happiness, and what specific form you want that to take in your own life, and then going after it ambitiously and not accommodating, but crafting. And the Stoics have a lot to say about kind of crafting your character, but a lot of the crafting that's being done there is to get it so you can accommodate yourself appropriately to events, to what happens. They tell you don't want events to happen as you want them. Get yourself in a position where you want events to happen exactly as they do. And that's more of getting yourself to accommodate yourself to events. not to try to get the events to occur as you want them. And that's the, I take this as an accommodation versus ambition sort of view in terms of Stoicism and Objectivism.
So that beautiful contrast. My last burning question would be a takeoff on one of Mr. Holliday's books, and that is ego the enemy?
You know, that's a funny thing because I think ego is a package deal. So I think that's an objectivist term. Ego is Latin for self. It just means, it's Latin for I. It's literally the word I went to the store, you know.
Right.
So packages together your oneself, one's I, with what is often thought of as an overwhelming concern for how other people think of you and how you can think of yourself as superior to other people or something. There's something which I think is a genuinely negative trait. So when people, your ego is getting in the way, they don't always have a clear view about what they're talking about. But often what they'll say is like somebody is overly stubborn and they won't consider anybody else's thought because they thought of something first. And somebody's, oh, it's your ego getting in the way. Like you don't want to be shown to be wrong, or you don't want to have to take any advice or knowledge from someone else because as if you know it all. That's not a positive trait. That's a negative trait. Yeah. And that's, but it's packaging that sort of negative psychological reactions or attitudes with the self. And so is ego the enemy? Well, that kind of, what would you call it? I don't know how Holliday would define ego. I haven't read that book. So if the shoe fits, fine. If it doesn't, then fine. But I think the self, put it this way, the self is not the enemy. The self is who you are. And it might be your enemy if you've built yourself in such a way that you're no good or you're irrational or you're wicked or something. Okay, yeah, you can build yourself into a self, or you can build your character such that who you are is a problem and you need to fix that. But the thinking of the self as associating the self with one's enemy, I think, is not a good thing in the culture. But I'd have to look at what he actually says about how he thinks about ego, because he might think of it is in the more conventional sense. Like the guy's got a big ego, like he's got an overinflated sense of his self-worth, or he's overly stubborn, refuses to accept advice or anything from anybody else because he allegedly knows it all. And I think it's a lack of self-esteem, really, that is at the root of what people often call ego. And it's a desire to project that you're somehow better than other people. It's a desire to project yourself as superior in some ways when you feel inferior, I think, often in certain ways. And when I mean superior, it could be just various, I don't mean metaphysically superior, just superior in some respect. And it's a desire, because you could be superior to someone in some respect, like you could be smarter, or you could be better looking, or you could be more intelligent, or better thinking abstractly, or, you know, whatever it is. But it's the concern to show that to other people, to make it known to other people, to put it on the table so everyone can see it, and in a way that I think shows more of a problem of self-esteem and an over-concern with other people's view of you. That's a problem. Yeah.
Right. I mean, people with genuine self-esteem,
yeah, and they don't
need to do that, I would say.
Because it's something that people do to make up for.
Right. And they don't, yeah.
It's because what they want is other people to think, oh man, he's got the answers, or oh, he's so smart, or they need that. They need to hear that from the outside to convince themselves. And I think that's it's a self-esteem problem. I'm not a psychologist, but I think that's what's at root of that, some of the behaviors that are conventionally thought of in terms of ego.
I see. Well, that's, do you have in your article, which I have in front of me, but were there any other specific criticisms of, Stoicism that you want to mention?
Yeah, I mean, the two major criticisms that I bring up in the article, one is the Stoics offer you all sorts of advice about how you should conduct your life, what kinds of values to pursue, what kind of perspective you should have on life, what things to value, and so on. And yet, it's a determinist philosophy. And so it doesn't make sense to give all this advice and tell people how they ought to behave if they're going to behave exactly as they do behave no matter what. So you can't tell people, I'm going to give you this empowering philosophy to tell you, here's all sorts of ways in which you can reshape your life and stuff, but you don't have any free will. It's a fundamental Okay, it's an irreconcilable problem. Now, the Stoics were smart enough to realize that there is an issue here, and we have to find a way to explain this, because they've got this whole cosmic determinism view. And on the other hand, they say some things are up to you. So what does it mean to say that some things are up to you? And the Stoics' answer, as far as we can tell, this is Chrysippus's answer as reported by Cicero. So it's okay. Whichever. But he gave, it's basically that an act is up to you if it results from causes that are within you, not just external causes, like somebody shoves you into somebody else, right? That's just an external cause.
Right.
And but if it's so, if some of your judgments and motives and so on are part of the causal story of the resulting action, then that's something that's up to you, because ultimately the causality has to in some way go through your own internal judgment. So, but ultimately, I think Chrysippus's view is that, but all of those internal causes, your judgments, your desires, your values, in the end are part of the whole fated system. So, because if they could say, and they could have said it, but if they, and there's a question about Epictetus as to whether he was introducing a notion of free will or not. And I deal with this in the article. I don't think he is, but if they told you that you're, so they have this view that when something strikes you as true, like it seems like this is a harebrained idea, or it seems to you that you've lost something important. When something strikes you, they call that an impression. You don't automatically, so you have the power of what they call assent. So they're like, it's like someone coming to give you a report, and you can look at the report carefully and then decide whether you're going to accept the report as true. They call that assent. You can say, yes, this is true. Indeed, I have lost a value. Yes, having thought about it, this is a harebrained idea. You know, so something can strike you as true or good, and then you have the power of assent. You can consider whether you're going to say, yeah, I agree, this is true, or you can withhold assent if it's unclear whether it's true or not, or you can reject it as false. So it's the, so your assent is like the gatekeeper. And if they said, and sometimes they'll say that your assent is up to you. And if that is, it seems like you have some cognitive control, at least over what judgments you hold, but it's unclear how they can fit that into an overall determinist system. The usual answer in among contemporary philosophers, and I think this is the most popular view on the issue of free will among contemporary philosophers, is what they call compatibilism. It's basically a redefining of free will so that it fits with determinism. So that you, basically, so you can have a view that, and I think there's all sorts of, confusions about what determinism is, but it's basically, you can have a fully deterministic system, but if you explain free will in such a way that makes it compatible, so that what we call volition or free will is compatible with determinism, then the problem goes away. But then what my point about that is, then you don't have free will. So you can define free will in such a way that it's consistent with its opposite. So put it this way, you can say, sure, human beings make choices, but the specific choices they make, they had to make. So it's a way of saying, well, yeah, you have choice. And if you had made a different choice, yeah, you would have acted differently. But you couldn't have made a different choice. So they try to sort of have it and not have it. They try to have their free will and eat it too. And that's the determinism problem. The other problem is their approach to valuing. Basically, it's you should only value, or you can say you should only really value, the things over which you have complete control that are totally up to you. And I'll tell you that sometimes your character, your moral character, your judgments and so on, your desires, your internal state, not all of it, but some of it. And that's what you should really value, because that's what you have full control over. And the other things that you don't, your body, your looks, your wealth, your home, your child, these things you don't have fully control over. So it's, you can value them in a sense, but not too much. Don't get too attached to them. So there's a kind of a detachment from a wide range of values that I think we should have a lot of attachment to. I mean, not everything is the end all be all of life, right? So it's, you have to have a hierarchy, and like some things are more important than other things, and you should value some things much more than other things. So I'm all for the hierarchy, but it's this perspective on, well, if you can't fully control them, you should not invest as much into them because you could lose them, and so on. Yeah. I mean, those are the two main systems I bring up. Yeah.
That's great. So you're at the epicenter, if you will, of spreading objectivism at the Ayn Rand Institute. Do you see any progress or any inroads that are happening in the culture? If that's not too loaded a question.
No, it's not too loaded. No, the issue is what we're trying to do. So Stoicism had 600 years.
Yes.
Objectivism is formulated basically in the 1950s and 60s.
Right.
So we're at the beginning of a new philosophy on the scene, and it's highly unconventional in such a way that there is a long process of change and learning and reintegration and spreading of the ideas in the culture, which is also a difficult thing. So to point to specific areas of progress, I think one is, or metrics of progress, I think would be, well, one thing is Ayn Rand's name is now, I mean, she's an icon now. True. I think that's relevant. She's a cultural icon. You mention Ayn Rand, people get angry, but they know who she is.
True.
And they might not know much about her philosophy or have a superficial view about what she stands for, but they'll associate her with some things, with capitalism or self-interest or whichever. But you can say Ayn Rand and people will know, oh yeah, that lady, you know, so they know who she is. And I think, so there's cultural currency to her name. So it's, we're not any longer. So this is a definite thing I would regard as progress. Ayn Rand who?
Okay.
You don't get that as nearly as much today. And also the spreading of her ideas in internationally. There are still places where she's largely unknown, like France. And there's places where she's starting to be significantly more known. And the more things we can do internationally. I don't care where fans from Ayn Rand come from, or fans of Ayn Rand.
Right.
Or exactly. People who find a philosophy of ambition and rationality and self-interest, rational self-interest, valuable. I could care less where they come from. So we've had some efforts in spreading objectivism abroad. And now with the ability to communicate with wide ranges of people through social media, through platforms like YouTube and so on, that there's a whole range of audience that you can get if you can reach the right kind of minds. And so there's no way to hide that this is a difficult project. Not that you hide it, but there's no way to get around it. It's a challenging thing. But for me, because so I'm at root a teacher. I think in my soul, so to speak, like I'm a teacher. And what I do is I do something really meaningful to me that, in my own way, and in my own sphere, can advance the cause of ideas that I think are better, more rational, and good. And so when I teach teach students in the Objectivist Academic Center, that's what I'm doing. When I give public talks, that's what I'm doing. If I give a podcast, that's what I'm doing. I'm trying in whatever way I can. I'm not Superman, but in whatever ways I can to try to spread ideas I think are true and good. And I think that's the only approach you can take. And the rest, a lot of the rest is strategy and knowing how to try to getting better at reaching the kinds of active-minded, more rational people that will at least think about the ideas and they're willing to consider ideas even if they're unconventional or jarring or surprising. But that's going to be a process for a long time. But if nobody engages in the process, it'll never happen. So it's not.
Well,
Aaron, could that be a thing then? We talk about social media activities and books like Ryan had written and Timothy Ferris have talked about on his podcast and also done his, I think, some kind of, not manual, but he has also taking Stoics texts and put it together, that you from that could find Miss Rand's ideas and objectivism.
You mean adopt some similar strategy?
Yeah, or search further and as I did in my teens, I want to find an integrated system of ideas. And I was interested in politics back in the day as a teenager,
right,
and so on.
Right.
And then started reading Rand's work. And we had a magazine called Lyceum in Sweden, and we got to translate things into Swedish and others, and we were at book fairs. But now, I mean, you could do a Google search and find. her name, and so.
Yeah, that's the other
thing. And now, if like interest in Stoicism and to read something, and they may say, oh, these ancient Greek and ideas and life hacks and tricks and successful individuals and et cetera, and then find Rand's ideas. That maybe could be a thing.
Yeah, I mean, if they can move from an interest in something like, I want to improve my life.
Yeah.
And to, you know, you look here and you look there and you look there and find objectivism in some way. If we can do that, I think that's better, because I think objectivism has the capacity to improve people's lives. The trick, though, is Holiday and Ferris, and I don't mean to single them out, but sure, we've just been talking about them, is they can rely on conventional attitudes and perspectives in the culture. In ways that objectivism can't. When I read books on Stoicism by modern thinkers today, I don't mean academic books, but popularizers, in a way it's so conventional, the viewpoint, because there's a lot of similarities between this and, you know, Christianity or Buddhism, or there's just so many things that they can rely on in the culture that are already there, that they've already activated, that they can rely on. They don't have to fight this uphill battle. If you tell them that, you know, everything they think of is good is evil. I mean, that's kind of really hard. The essence of the way they think about morality is wrong. And you have a different view that they've taught to been think what that they have been taught to think of as evil, as the opposite, the antithesis of morality. And the culture has this view. You have a real battle. If you tell people, don't sweat the, I'm deliberately being a little flippant here, but it's don't sweat the small stuff. Keep focused on what you can control. It just sounds like, yeah, okay, fair enough. You know, smart. Or the kind of advice you see, it's pretty conventional. And there's some good stuff in it, and there's some not good stuff in it. But it's just, it's easy in a way that spreading objectivism is not. I mean, people think capitalism is evil. She's an advocate of capitalism. People think self-interest is evil. She's an advocate of self-interest. She's an advocate of reason. People have very mixed views about the issue of reason. And some people think it's limited. You can use it here in the lab, you know, but what about love and your emotional life? And it doesn't apply to those areas and so on. And so people are ambivalent toward reason. They think of it as some kind of cold, sterile, unemotional view, which it's not, but they think of it in that way. Many people are attached to some kind of religious or mystical worldview. I mean, just think of the number of religious people. Ayn Rand rejects that completely. So there's so much that's controversial in it that it takes much more time and also really articulate, knowledgeable advocates and teachers and explainers, if you want to put it that way, of the philosophy. And there aren't that many. And so it's one of these things that I think more and more people, the more they know and have the ability to understand and to teach it and grasp it and apply it, the application is important. I think a philosophy is difficult to apply. You know, it's not obvious how to accurately and properly apply philosophic principles to particular concretes. That's a challenge. But one of the things that people really like about Stoicism is it's heavily practical. In other words, it's focused. I don't mean it's practical, but it's heavily focused on practical issues. Like if you go on some of the Stoic Facebook groups and so on, which I dip into every once in a while to see kind of what's going on, what people are talking about. And it's a lot about, I have this physical condition that's undergoing a lot of pain. What would Stoics say? How do I get some advice or some relief? My brother's girlfriend broke up with him and he's really depressed. What kind of Stoic guidance can I give him? You know, it's that sort of rubber meets the road. It's where life hits you in the cheek, you know?
Yeah.
And what do I do? So it's people looking often for relief. And what do I do? You know, do I take a Tylenol or an Advil or what do I do? And it's so, yeah, I mean, you could write a book about applying so objectivism. If you want to see how objectivism applies to the world, read the novels, read Atlas Shrugged, and you see how these ideas impact and influences people's lives and perspectives and emotions and relationships all over the place. But a lot of the advice, if someone asked me to write a book like that, I don't think I'd do it. In part because if you're giving people some sort of therapeutic advice, I'd need to know much more about their situation, much more about their context, how they got to where they were, what their own perspective are, how they frame it to themselves, and just, I need to know so much, like a friend, like a close friend. You didn't know a lot about them to give specific advice about what to do. But you can give advice. I mean, if you think of like Leonard Peikoff had, Dr. Leonard Peikoff had that podcast, where largely what he was doing was that. And that's not only what he was doing, but it's very interesting. People are asking everything from, you know, relationships to sex to everything. And it's more like, how do I think about this? And is this right? Is this wrong? And what if this? And, you know, what's an objectivist way of addressing that or dealing with that? And that's very interesting.
Yeah, it is. Well. I mean, they were great.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Listen, I don't want to end this, but my phone is down to like 6%.
So, when I will do a quick one, Blair, here. So who would you, Aaron, listen to in your future as a guest? Do you have any suggestions or topics that you would like to listen to?
Ah.
Way out of left field there.
Well, no, I would need some prep for that. I'd have to think about exactly what I would.
Please do.
Let me follow. I'll follow up with an email.
That sounds great.
Because I'm happy to weigh in on that. I just don't have to right on the top of my head.
Great.
That's great.
Thanks, Aaron. And to end there and wrap up, where could the listeners find you in cyberspace?
Oh, if you just Google Ayn Rand Institute, Aaron Smith, you'll find me in multiple places, both on YouTube, on the Ayn Rand Institute's website, lots of places it will show up. One thing I will say is that if you're a listener of the program and you're interested in Stoicism, and you want to look at some writings that Ayn Rand wrote. Now, Ayn Rand didn't write on Stoicism, but about some of the issues that Stoicism deals with, addresses, grapples with. I would recommend two articles. One, they're both in her book, Philosophy, Who Needs It? And one is called The Metaphysical Versus the Man-Made, which deals with the idea of what is up to you and what's not. And her article, Causality Versus Duty. And it has to do with the nature of morality, which I think both of which would be interesting to someone who's actually interested in Stoicism. And what they find there, they may not agree with, but they'll see parallels. They'll see this. They're grappling with some of the same issues in interesting ways. So anyway, I'll throw that out there.
That's great. Thank you. Thank you, Aaron.
Thanks.
You're welcome.
Right. We've been talking today with Aaron Smith, a fellow at the Ayn Rand Institute, about Stoicism, objectivism, and other things. And Aaron, thanks for manning the foxhole with us today.
Thanks a lot.